Welcome to Chemistry of the Mind, unlocking the brain's secrets, exploring the unseen universe within our minds. Today, we're delving into the fascinating world of serotonin.
Serotonin, it's often called the happy chemical, right? But there's so much more to it than just mood, isn't there?
Exactly. It's a monoamine neurotransmitter, crucial for a wide array of functions. Mood regulation, cognition, reward, learning, even vasoconstriction, and vomiting.
Vomiting? Oh, that's interesting. So where is this multifaceted chemical produced?
Primarily in the central nervous system, specifically the brainstem's RAFA nuclei. But get this, about 90% of the body's serotonin is actually in the GI tract, specifically the enterochromaffin cells.
The gut? So it's not just a brain thing?
Not at all. It plays a huge role in regulating intestinal movements. It's also stored in blood platelets, released during agitation and vasoconstriction.
So it's involved in both mood and drug clotting? That's a wild combination.
It is. It acts as a vasoconstrictor, especially in conditions like atherosclerosis or chronic hypertension, but it can also be a vasodilator, regulating hemostasis and clotting.
Wow. So how does it manage all these different roles? It must have different ways of interacting with the body.
Precisely. There are various serotonin receptors, 5-HT receptors, located on cell membranes throughout the body. They're what mediate serotonin's effects.
So like a lock and key system, different receptors for different functions?
Yeah, pretty much, except for the 5-HT3 receptor, which is a ligand-gated ion channel. Most of them are G protein-coupled receptors. They trigger intracellular cascades.
I see. And what about serotonin's connection to depression? I hear that a lot.
Well, the idea that low serotonin causes depression is a bit of an oversimplification. It's more complex than that.
Oh, really? So what's the real story?
Serotonin is definitely involved in mood regulation. Antidepressants like SSRIs and SNRIs work by interfering with serotonin reabsorption, increasing its levels in synapses.
So they keep the serotonin around longer?
Exactly. But the underlying causes of depression are multifaceted, not just the simple serotonin deficiency. Other neurotransmitters and factors play a role too.
That makes sense. It's never just one thing, is it?
Right. And interestingly, serotonin isn't limited to mammals. It's found in all bilateral animals, even insects and worms, and even in fungi and plants.
Plants? What does it do in plants?
It seems to be associated with stress signals, and in some cases, like insect venoms and plant spines, it actually causes pain.
Fascinating. So from mood to digestion to pain, serotonin is involved in so much. It really highlights how interconnected everything is in the body.
So we were talking about serotonin's varied roles, and it's truly remarkable how it pops up everywhere, from mood regulation to causing pain in plants.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling. So given its connection to mood, I'd love to unpack its relationship with mental health, especially depression.
Okay, well, the link between serotonin and depression is more nuanced than the happy chemical narrative suggests. It's not a simple case of low serotonin causing depression.
Right, you mentioned that earlier. It's more complicated.
Exactly. Think of it this way. Serotonin is definitely involved in mood regulation, but it's part of a complex interplay of neurotransmitters and other factors. Depression isn't solely a serotonin deficiency.
So how do antidepressants like SSRIs fit into this picture?
Well, SSRIs, or selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, work by increasing serotonin levels in the synapses, the spaces between nerve cells. They block the reabsorption or reuptake of serotonin, making it more available.
So they keep the serotonin around longer, giving it more time to act?
Precisely. But that doesn't mean the initial problem was a lack of serotonin. It's more like fine-tuning a complex system. Other neurotransmitters, like dopamine and norepinephrine, also play crucial roles in mood, and SSRIs can indirectly affect them too.
I see. It's like an orchestra, not a solo performance.
A perfect analogy. And, you know, serotonin's involvement extends beyond depression. It plays a role in anxiety disorders, obsessive-compulsive disorder, even eating disorders.
Oh. How so?
Well, for example, in OCD, some studies suggest that altered serotonin function might contribute to the obsessive thoughts and compulsive behaviors. And in eating disorders, serotonin seems to influence appetite and satiety, potentially contributing to disordered eating patterns.
Wow. So modulating serotonin can have a ripple effect across multiple mental health conditions.
So we were discussing serotonin's role in various mental health conditions, and it's clear it's not as simple as just low serotonin equals depression.
Yeah, it's way more intricate than that. It's fascinating how much we're still learning about the brain and its chemistry.
Absolutely. This input we're looking at mentions a bunch of other factors that contribute to mental disorders, like genetics, environment, even personality traits.
Oh, like what kind of personality traits?
Well, it mentions a propensity for high neuroticism or emotional instability as a risk factor for mental illness, and for anxiety, temperament, and attitudes can play a role.
That makes sense. Some people just seem wired to be more anxious than others, right?
It seems that way. And the environment plays a huge role too. Things like childhood trauma, neglect, social stress, they can all increase the risk.
So nature, nurture, as they say.
Exactly. And then there's the whole discussion about diagnosis, which seems to be a bit of a minefield.
How so?
Well, the input talks about the DSM and ICD, the diagnostic manuals used by psychiatrists, and how they've been criticized for having a Euro-American bias.
Oh, interesting. So they might not be applicable to all cultures?
That's the argument. Even if the criteria used across cultures, it doesn't necessarily mean the underlying constructs are valid in those cultures. It's a complex issue.
I see. So how do we move forward with diagnosis then? If these manuals aren't perfect, what's the alternative?
Well, some researchers are advocating for a more culturally sensitive approach, recognizing that different cultures might have different ways of understanding and experiencing mental distress. The input also mentions the challenges of comorbidity, where someone meets the criteria for multiple disorders.
Right. It's rarely just one thing. It's like a tangled web.
Precisely. And then there's the whole debate about the medicalization of everyday life. Are we pathologizing normal human experiences?
That's a good question. Where do we draw the line between normal sadness and, say, clinical depression?
It's a tough one. And the input mentions some critics who argue that mental illness is really about suffering, and the DSM just creates labels to categorize that suffering. It's a thought-provoking perspective.
It is. So if diagnosis is so complex, what about treatment? What are the options?
Well, the input discusses various approaches, including psychotherapy, medication, lifestyle changes, even things like electroconvulsive therapy in severe cases.
ECT? That sounds intense.
It is, and it's usually reserved for treatment-resistant depression or other extreme situations. But for many people, therapy and medication can be very effective, especially when used together.
Makes sense. A multi-pronged approach.
So we're delving into some pretty dense research here and looking at the complex factors that contribute to mental disorders.
Yeah, it's a lot to unpack. It seems like everything from genetics to cultural biases plays a role.
Absolutely. This input touches on some really interesting studies, like one in JAMA Psychiatry about non-random mating patterns within major psychiatric disorders. It suggests that people with certain mental illnesses might be more likely to partner with others who have similar conditions.
Oh, that's fascinating. I wonder why that is.
Well, it could be due to shared experiences, similar social circles, or even a perceived understanding of each other's challenges.
I see. So it's not necessarily a genetic link, but more of a social one?
Potentially. And then there's the impact of stress during development, which this input highlights as a major factor in neuroplasticity and psychopathology.
Right, like childhood trauma or neglect. We talked about that earlier.
Exactly. And this input also mentions the social context of mental illness and violence, citing a study that explores the complex relationship between the two.
That's a sensitive topic. It's important to remember that correlation doesn't equal causation.
Definitely. Having a mental illness doesn't automatically make someone violent. In fact, people with mental disorders are often more likely to be victims of violence than perpetrators.
That's true. So what other factors are we looking at here?
Well, the input mentions urbanicity, or living in urban areas, as a potential environmental influence on schizophrenia, particularly for those with a genetic predisposition.
Interesting. I wonder if it's the stress of city life or something else entirely.
It's hard to say definitively. And then there's the role of nutrition, which some researchers are suggesting should be mainstream in psychiatry. They argue that nutritional deficiencies can exacerbate mental health issues.
That makes sense. Our brains need the right fuel to function properly.
Precisely. And, you know, this input covers a wide range of other factors, too. Everything from temperament and attitudes and anxiety to the potential risks of cannabis use.
It's amazing how many different things can influence our mental well-being.
So this research paper really dives into the complexities of serotonin and its connection to a whole spectrum of mental disorders.
Yeah, it's fascinating how they're using neuroimaging like PET and SPECT scans to actually visualize what's happening in the brain.
It's amazing, right? They can actually see how serotonin receptors and transporters are functioning or malfunctioning in different brain regions.
So, what are some of the key takeaways here? What disorders are they focusing on?
Well, they cover a lot of ground. Major depressive disorder, or MDD, is a big one, of course, but they also look at bipolar disorder, anxiety disorders, schizophrenia, addiction, even ADHD and autism.
Wow, that's a pretty comprehensive list. So, what's the connection between serotonin and MDD? Is it as simple as low serotonin levels causing depression?
Not quite. The research suggests that it's more nuanced than that. Some studies show lower serotonin receptor binding potential in people with MDD, while others show the opposite, especially in those taking antidepressants. It's complicated.
So, what about serotonin transporters? What role do they play?
Well, serotonin transporters, or SERTs, are responsible for reabsorbing serotonin from the synapse, and there's evidence suggesting that SERT availability might be lower in the midbrain of people with MDD, but again, the findings aren't entirely consistent.
It seems like there's a lot of conflicting research in this area.
Yeah, there is, but that's often the case with brain research. It's incredibly complex. And, you know, this paper also highlights the importance of considering other factors like genetics, environment, and even personality traits.
Oh, like what kind of personality traits?
Well, they mention neuroticism or emotional instability as a potential risk factor, and there's some evidence linking higher SERT binding potential with neuroticism in healthy males. Interesting. So it's not just about serotonin itself, but also how it interacts with other factors.
Precisely. And the paper goes on to discuss the role of serotonin in other disorders too.
Right. With bipolar disorder, there's evidence of both increased and decreased SERT binding potential, depending on the study. And with anxiety disorders, the findings are even less conclusive.
So, what about schizophrenia? Any connection there?
Not much, surprisingly. The research hasn't really shown a clear link between serotonin and schizophrenia, at least not in terms of neuroimaging findings.
Huh, that's unexpected. And what about addiction? I know serotonin is involved in reward pathways.
Yeah, it is. But the relationship between serotonin and addiction seems to be pretty complex. Some studies show reduced SERT availability in alcoholics, while others show increased availability in smokers. It's a mixed bag.
It seems like we still have a lot to learn about how serotonin influences these different conditions.
Absolutely. And this paper really underscores that point. It highlights the need for more research to fully understand the role of serotonin in mental health.
Well, it definitely gives us a lot to think about. Thanks for breaking it down for us. It's been a fascinating discussion.
It was my pleasure. And to all our listeners, thank you for tuning in to Chemistry of the Mind. Until next time, keep exploring the fascinating universe within.